Coming up on the WSJ Media Mix podcast, we dissect Google's plans for a new web TV service, YouTube TV, and discuss what to expect from Snapchat's imminent IPO.
Welcome to the WSJ Media Mix podcast, bringing you interviews and analysis with people that matter in the fast-changing media business.
Hello and welcome to the WSJ Media Mix podcast. I'm Jack Marshall. I'm joined today by my colleagues, WSJ Senior Editor Michael Shields. Mike, how are you?
Good, Jack. How are you?
And Media and Marketing Bureau Chief Amol Sharma. Amol, thanks for joining us.
What's up, fellas?
Cool. Okay, so the big news this week in the media and marketing world is Google announcing plans for a new web TV service called YouTube TV. I think it's called YouTube TV.
It is.
Creative.
The rumor was, I think it was supposed to be like Unplugged or something like that. That's what we were planning. And then it turned out to be YouTube TV.
YouTube TV. Well,
came out of nowhere, right. That name, I tell you. A lot of focus groups for
yes,
that one.
Yes, yes.
So anyway, the deal is over 40 broadcasting cable channels, I believe, for $35 a month. No time frame yet. I think they're saying in the next few months is what they've said so far. They're not the first to offer this type of service. AT&T has a similar offering with DirecTV Now. There's Sling TV, of course. Sony has an offering with PlayStation View, I think it's called.
Yep.
I guess the big question here is around the content. A lot of people throw around sort of the idea of a skinny bundle. This bundle is sort of skinnier, perhaps, than some of the other bundles out there. But what was your guys' take on that? I know it's sort of heavy on the sports side, which I guess is important for a live TV offering. But
yeah, I mean, it was now we're getting used to these things coming out. It's like this, as we noted today in our newsletter, the list of skinny bundles is getting fat now. I mean, there's now what, Sling, Sony, you named them. You know, the others are coming. Amazon's working on one. Hulu's is coming out soon. So the thing you got to do right away is okay, it's $35 a month. That sounds sensational to people who are looking to cut their cable bill or did cut the cord or are cord nevers or whatever. But now you got to race through and find out what channels are in there, what channels are not. And that was what we were all doing. So the ones that, you know, all the big broadcasters made it. So ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox. And then what was interesting is all of their parent companies that own cable networks, all those cable channels got in there. So that means all the major Disney channels, the major, the other CBS channels, Showtime, which CBS owns, the Fox channels got in there. And the NBC Universal channel, so you had Bravo and E and MSNBC and all that. What you don't see is the glaring one was Time Warner, which owns CNN, HBO, TBS, TNT.
Through Turner,
right. Yeah. Those channels, yeah. And so that's the biggest one. A Turner executive made some remarks today saying, like, good luck, fellas, if you don't have us in there. And then there's a list of other companies. You know, you expect there to be a negotiation with Turner at some point. It would be amazing if Google didn't try to add those channels. But then Viacom, Discovery, Scripps, which owns the Food Network, those ones aren't in there. And you know, the big question is, are those types of channels going to make it into a skinny bundle like this? And that has huge implications for their future.
But it seems like all of these bundles offer sort of something different, right? Because Turner channels are in some of the other bundles, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, they are in. Yeah, they're in Sling and they're in some of the other ones. Yeah, so there are variations in some of the different bundles. But mostly if you're going to, it's all kind of coming together around a price that's within the $35 to $40 range. And then a set of similar channels, and I think it would be difficult to, especially in this climate when news is, you know, cable news is doing really well. They're all kind of at record highs, including CNN, and to not have CNN or HBO when,
yeah,
particularly if you're launching right around the time that all HBO's big shows are about to come out.
Although to be clear, I don't think HBO comes as standard with any of the other packages?
No, it's a premium edition.
But,
you have to be able to offer it.
This, yeah, one, right? Yeah. You can't even add it on.
Right.
But you can still pay HBO Direct for that content.
True. Yes, you could.
It's not sort of a deal breaker. If you want to watch HBO, you can.
That's true. Yeah, you can go direct.
Like, the more of these that come out, though, they all feel a little bit incomplete and starting to feel a little random. Like, what's this? Who's this? I'm not totally sure who this is for, other than just people that like YouTube or the younger crowd. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I thought the sport element was interesting with YouTube, because, I mean, we hear all the time that sport is sort of, you know, the last bastion of live TV. And it seems like they've done a pretty good job there. You know, they've got the Fox Sports channels, NBC Sports. So, I don't know, Mike, you're a big sports fan. Did it sort of pique your interest?
Yeah, but I immediately start doing the math, and I'm like, well, I need MSG, and I need YES, because I need my local teams, even though I probably shouldn't watch Knick games. Like, I still kind of want that. Like, you start doing the math, and then if you want to throw on HBO, and if you have Netflix, you start wondering, is it really a good deal or not? I don't know. It does pique your curiosity with ESPN there.
And then you still have to pay for internet access. I mean, that's sort of the, you know, internet is often bundled with your cable subscription, right? Which
offset the cost. This whole calculation of if it's worth it or not compared to your cable package is actually quite complicated for every person. It just depends. If you're heavy into sports but you don't like all the other channels, then you have a certain view of it. If you only like a few channels in the bundle and those happen to be in one of these skinny bundles, you're set. So it's kind of tough, but it is getting, I agree, it's getting a little bit challenging / random to look through what they offer. And the other big thing here from the business standpoint is it's really going to be hard for any company doing this to make money at the $35 price. If you talk to any of the analysts who follow this closely, they will tell you that a new player, even if it's Google, which makes $90 billion a year in revenue, Google is still a tiny, you know, new player in television still. So they're going to be paying higher prices to carry all these channels than somebody else, like Comcast or Charter. So already they're at a premium. And then so you get to $35. One of the analysts said, look, their content costs for this YouTube TV thing are probably around $30 now. That doesn't include the Time Warner channels or any of the other ones we talked about. $35. They're at a $5 margin. That gap could narrow, and you just think they're not really trying to make money off this. You know, they have bigger designs. I mean, they're an ad company, and you know, get into that. But it doesn't seem like this is going to be some high margin thing, at least not off the bat.
And to your point, I guess if they do add more content, then you would assume that they would perhaps have to raise the price to.
They said they won't. They're like, this is the price. Even if we had more partners.
This isn't an entry-level thing. They're not talking about it that way, right?
They weren't exactly clear on that. And DirecTV and AT&T did play some funny games around. There was like the initial thing, and then it kind of went up a little bit. But they didn't talk about that here. They actually seemed to suggest that they're going to stick with this, even if they add additional quote-unquote content partners. So that means that margin just crunches further if you add other people. Of course, again, they may not add some of those other networks at all.
So, I mean, you mentioned the ad piece there as well. Mike, I know you've been sort of doing some digging around this, but do we have a sense yet of how the advertising will work? My understanding is YouTube will have the ability to sell sort of the local, what would typically be cable carrier time slots
right just like a Comcast or another pay TV company has access to those 2 minutes an hour on cable networks. YouTube will be able to sell that ad inventory. They definitely have not emphasized that part of this in their announcement, and it seems like some of the details are still being figured out. Even like a lot of the agencies I've been talking to today don't know all the details yet, how it'll work. I don't even know if the ads are going to launch on day one, but it's interesting for a couple of reasons for YouTube. It potentially helps them bring more premium inventory to help them sell more ads on YouTube. It kind of helps them dress up the vast sea of mid to high quality to low quality, depending on your point of view, stuff on YouTube. So that helps maybe bring in the advertiser that's not sure about that stuff.
Do you think they would package it?
I think it's probably a great dressing up mechanism for YouTube ad inventory, or it gets them in conversations with advertisers that were a little bit iffy on the whole YouTube prospect of UGC.
Up to this point, what's it been like? They go into they're trying to sell to a TV buyer, and they're like, hey, this stuff we have, it's not TV, but it's like, you know, it's like web premium. It's basically TV. I mean, what's been the conversation?
I think they very much leaned into, we have these homegrown stars that your kids know that you don't know. This is like the next generation MTV, for lack of a better analogy. You need to be here. We're you know, they throw around these crazy numbers all the time. Like, we're bigger than all of television on our mobile platform among younger demos and things like that. That's been their sell. I think they've made big strides, I think, in the last couple of years. But, you know, I think there's still a lot of advertisers that don't love the idea of, like, this stuff doesn't feel like Grey's Anatomy to me, or, you know, premium sports, or they just don't know where their ads are going to be at any given time, or these influencers are unpredictable. So there's definitely some of that pitch that they've had to face. So I think this probably gets them, like, maybe the more conservative brands that weren't crazy about them, they can view them in a more television light.
Well, I mean, I guess they can go in and say, you know, this is TV.
Yeah.
And by the way, we also have this other stuff that you can buy.
Right, and we can really extend your reach in a big way, and this is definitely going to be the cord cutter younger crowd that you're missing a lot of time in your campaigns. That's probably going to be a big approach.
So do we have a sense of how, again, I know it's earlier, there aren't many details, but how the ads might be sort of sold or targeted? Because typically on YouTube, you know, advertisers can sort of cherry pick certain audiences or, you know, certain demographics. Is it going to be along those lines, do you think, or is it going to be more akin to sort of traditional TV?
Again, Google still, like, doesn't have a lot of details on this, but they're talking about, like, they would like to experiment with dynamic advertising. In other words, bringing some elements of digital advertising, much more targeted, the right ad for the right person, the right moment, to television, which is, you know, typically it's sold, you know, the whole country gets the same ad at the same time, no matter what, if you're buying a car or not. So I think they like to experiment with that. I think some of the agencies I've talked to initially are saying, you know, hold on a second, this thing has no subscribers yet. This is not going to be significant for maybe a year or two. But it's Google, and they, you know, if anybody's going to do this well, they should. And it's an advantage that they have probably over the other skinny bundle contenders out there.
It's going to be interesting to see if Google, if this gives AT&T an even stronger argument on the Time Warner merger when it's going through regulatory approval. They've basically been making the case that Google, to a large extent, as well as Facebook, but that's their real competition, that they're trying to save the rest of us from the duopoly. That's right. AT&T's job in life at the moment. But they kind of got a gift here.
It's not going to hurt their cause.
It's not going to hurt, because they're coming directly onto the turf of the pay TV companies. And one of the things that AT&T has talked up doing, I mean, actually, like, the very first press conference with the executives after the merger they're talking about targeted addressable advertising, and that's, like, a big thing they're going to invest in. And now you have Goliath trying to do the same thing, who's already good at it.
Right. They've got a long history of doing that and making tons of money on it. So, yeah, it really does.
And you need more games in town who actually have scale and clout and deep pockets to do that. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. And then the other thing was this notion that if they are selling ads and they're selling TV inventory basically to the same kinds of marketers that the networks are, isn't that could potentially be a weird competitive?
Well, they're going to be competing directly with the networks, aren't they? I mean,
yeah,
YouTube sells into the same brands that the networks do.
Yeah, Coke and Pepsi and all those other guys. Although someone was saying to me, this could bring, like, a new breed of advertiser doesn't typically do a lot of television, but is really performance based, and maybe they'll find the economics work for them to try this kind of advertising. Like, I don't know, Airbnbs of the world, or these,
like,
kind of
the typical
data-driven
online advertisers.
Yeah, so that could be a whole new group of a whole new pool of dollars potentially.
That's interesting. Do we have a sense? We should probably touch on what this could mean for YouTube's business as well. I know they announced this week, as we covered, that I think they said 100 billion hours of video are viewed a day on YouTube now. But it's still unclear.
I think they crossed the billion mark, right?
Yeah.
A billion.
What did I say?
These numbers get so big, they stop being right.
That's a lot.
But my point is, it's still unclear if they're really making money. I mean, Google never really sort of breaks YouTube out. As Amol, you sort of already touched on, you know, it's possible they're losing money on this to an extent. But
yeah, I mean, this they don't break out the financials, but the last reports that people are aware of are that YouTube was, like, break even a couple of years ago. It's in the sort of was in the low single digit, like in the four to 5 billion or something like that. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it's not in terms of revenue. So despite the 1 billion hours, you have to put that in context. It's still a fraction of the ad revenue of the, you know, whatever it is, close to $70 billion spent in the U.S. every year on TV ads. So they still have a long way to go, but it's also kind of one of the areas of great potential of the company. So that's perhaps why this stuff has so much promise. And they have tried for years. I mean, they have been trying to get this bundle or something like it for like 5 years. They've come back around to the TV companies. They showed up the first time like, yeah, we're going to pay a really discounted price for Google. And then some of those executives would tell us reporters like, yeah, it was fun. We talked to them for like 5 minutes and told them to, you know, take a hike and come back when they're serious. And then they've tried all kinds of other stuff like little set-top box things, and they had
Google TV ads business that came and went. That
exactly.
It was trying to be like auction-style TV
auction-style TV ads, and so
that was years ago as well. They were sort of early to this game.
But what's amazing is that YouTube they've almost owned it for, is it more than a decade now? I mean, it's like
I think it's been around since 2005, and they maybe
bought it in 2007 or something, right? So it's been quite a while, and they are definitely looking for that hockey stick moment on the revenue and profitability, and you know, like a real margin. They talk about they're building for growth right now. They're not building for profit, and you can tell that from this bundle pricing, as we mentioned. But at some point, that's going to have to become like a margin contributor to the business, or the investors will get tired of YouTube.
Yeah.
Do we have a sense as well? We should probably mention YouTube did already have a subscription service, or does already have one called YouTube Red.
Right.
Do we know how this kind of fits in? I mean, do subscribers have access to that content as well? I mean, I believe you do.
I don't think it doesn't give you the ad-free YouTube experience, but I think you can get some of those shows, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that would be interesting to see how that pans out. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Love tech? Dig gadgets? Then make Tech News Briefing from the Wall Street Journal a part of your day. WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the WSJ Media Mix podcast. The other big news this week in the world of digital media is, of course, the Snap Inc. IPO, parent company of Snapchat, of course, which is expected to debut on the stock exchange tomorrow, I believe, pricing its IPO of up to $25 billion. Fascinating, a lot of eyeballs on this one. Everyone's sort of wondering, the narrative, is it going to be the next Twitter? Is it going to be the next Facebook? A few interesting things came up in its S1 filing a few weeks ago. Notably, it's sort of comparing itself in size to some of the Facebooks and Googles of the world. So I was just kind of interested to ask you guys what you're going to be looking out for in terms of, I know a lot of people are looking at growth. Audience growth is sort of an interesting one. That's one where Twitter has struggled. Facebook has obviously just sort of managed to keep on growing somehow. Growth for Snap has been slowing in recent quarters, I believe. What are you guys sort of looking out for?
One of the interesting things people have to keep in mind is that it's really easy to overreact in either direction to the quality and the sort of future promise of a new public company, especially these tech companies that are built for growth, investors are trying to project things and forecast things that are very hard to know.
Is this in reference to the $25 billion valuation?
Yes. But also, you know, Facebook, as we know, had a rough couple of months. They were down like 20% or so around that time after a couple months. And then I think it wasn't until like a year later that they actually got back to the IPO price. And then it just soared and essentially never looked back. Of course, they've had, you know, some dips here and there, but you know, it just basically has soared. Twitter started out somewhat better than that, actually, in the first couple of months. And then, you know, we've seen what's happened to Twitter, and that thing is underwater, way, way underwater compared to the IPO. So it's, who knows? I think it's going to be hard to tell. There might be, it sounds like it's going to be priced pretty rich from our reporting and others. It's going to price late today, we're recording this Wednesday, and then it starts trading Thursday. And it sounds like their initial range, which was $14 to $16 a share, it might come in a little higher than that, which reflects that there's real appetite for this. Snap thinks they have a really strong hand. It also kind of elevates the expectations for the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, not only was Facebook's IPO messy, but they hadn't even gotten their mobile act together at that point, right? Like, how could you know like how well that would go? It's been incredible how well they transitioned, and that there was a time when their mobile product was lousy. So it's so hard to predict. You know, does Evan Spiegel have some amazing product up his sleeve that no one knows about? Like,
right? Is there anything for Snap like that? Like for Facebook, you could point to something that they weren't yet doing well. That was obviously when they got. Not obviously, but there was runway for a lot of growth when they figured out mobile. Is there something like that for Snap?
Maybe broadening the demographics. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's hard because they already are video. I mean, obviously that's sort of the hot area right now.
They're born on mobile, right?
They're already mobile. Yeah.
I mean, well, your demographic point is interesting though, and we were talking about this. The eMarketer, which. Obviously, as an independent, it's not coming directly from Snapchat. It's their estimates. But they had this thing out the other day that said, oh, actually, some of the user growth, the fastest user growth is going to be in the next year in the older demo over 45, not the younger demo. And I heard that and I didn't know, is that good or bad? Because they've been criticized for only getting the 18 right. to 30 people and that, you know, oh, they just can't, that's too confusing for people who are older or whatever.
Right, and that was always the fear at Facebook. If you get, you know, if mom came on, would it ruin it or whatever?
Yeah. On the other hand, I can't imagine a company going around being like, "Guys, we're signing up 45-year-olds." Right. Like nobody's
the
business.
Future.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's how they've been pitching their ad products. You know, it's
right.
You know, Facebook's for your parents. We reach the, you know, 18, 20, 22-year-olds. So.
I wonder with advertisers, are there enough that are going to because Snapchat it goes pretty young, right? I think it's like. Starts at 13 up. Like, are there enough advertisers that are going to want to put a lot of money there beyond like that still care about that TV audience that's very broad? Are there enough of those guys that are going to dive headfirst in and not just experiment there? I think that's a big challenge.
It's also interesting as well because I know I get the sense a lot of marketers have talked about Snapchat partially to sort of perhaps gain leverage against the big two, which are Facebook and Google. But it will be interesting to see if they sort of, to your point, put their money where their mouth is and go beyond just sort of experimental budgets and dipping a toe and starting to spend some serious money.
Yeah, I mean, but it all is going to come back to the investors, no matter what, are going to look at. They're going to look at the curve of ad spending growth and the big commitments they can get from holding companies and things that they can show mean that they have growth. But also... Let's face it. I mean, if they can, if the younger demo doesn't grow, or just user growth doesn't happen to the extent that people are looking for, and you can basically trace that to Instagram,
mm-hmm.
Instagram stories and Facebook being able to, or Instagram being able to match anything they do, that starts to become pretty scary. The barrier to entry doesn't seem to be that high to copy something that works on Snapchat. That's if I were an investor, isn't that what you'd be worried about based on what's happened? Their user growth slowed dramatically in the second half of last year after Instagram got into it. So that's the real pressure point, right?
I wonder if, on that note, do they ever feel pressure to change what they are because of stuff like that? Like, you know, do they want?
Well, they're a camera company, right?
But like, do you cave in and let people? You know, let people collect more data, or do you become more of a social network and copy Instagram a little bit of that where you have we can facilitate a network easier and find people because you know is the pressure to grow going to have them bend on any of their core principles? I don't know.
Well, that's really interesting because I feel like they already have. I remember a year, maybe 18 months ago, they were saying they weren't going to serve the type of creepy ads that perhaps some other online advertising companies were. Now, you know, they have
getting a little creepier.
The most sort of advanced. Targeting ad tech tools out there.
But they are the place they're most differentiated from Facebook feels like it's on the media side because they're essentially building a walled garden approach. It's very hard to get approved to get in there. Even the content in there gets policed. And it seems to be sort of the polar opposite. And you find all the big brands, you'll see Hearst and NBC Universal and Turner and then the new media guys, Vice and BuzzFeed are all in there. But it's the opposite of the news feed, which is like everything to the point where now they're spending half their time trying to police the fake news and convince people that you know, that there's the good and from the bad are being sorted out on Facebook. So maybe they'll like lean into that difference over time, and if that works for them. I mean, there's also evidence that the media is being consumed by older people compared to the younger people.
Right, which is a good thing over time. If they can get those media companies will help them bring in more advertisers and bring in more audience and you know, potential for hit shows, hit content in Snapchat that will be born on their platform is always going to help them over time.
So what do you make, just again on the scale note, in the S1, Snapchat, it felt, was sort of trying to emphasize engagement versus just pure size. What do you make of that claim? I mean, do you think we'll get to the point where they can really sort of grow their engagement to multiple hours a day? I mean, is that enough to drive growth without just attracting new users, do you think?
I wonder about how much of that engagement, I'd love to see numbers on this, how much of that engagement is non-monetizable time? You know what I mean? Like, people talk about those crazy streaks that young people go on in Snapchat. And it's like pure communication. I don't know how much of that is an ad opportunity. Yes, it helps make you so attached to the platform that it's your favorite thing in life, and that makes it valuable, more valuable to advertisers overall. But I wonder how much of that is actually stuff you can make money on. I don't know.
That should be part of these audits that are going on.
Right.
is breaking down that engagement metric in as many ways as they can to actually help a advertiser figure out, wait a minute, is this a time that eyeball is available to me or not? Right.
Definitely.
Yep. We'll have to wait and see. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, so we're going to wrap it up there. Amol, Mike, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks. Join us next time on the Media Mix podcast.
For more podcasts, check us out at wsj.com/podcasts. Become a subscriber on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and now look for us on the Google Play Music app on Android devices.